This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 289 was recorded on September 16th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Bianco Research founder Jim Bianco returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss secular inflation, demographics, decentralized finance, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick has prepared a terrific slide deck for you, which is titled Sizing Up the Markets and Emergent Trends.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's get to the S&P 500, which has been correcting for a week or so, but not a real breakdown or anything, just paused from its prior uptrends. What's your take on the markets here?
Well, I agree with your characterization. It blows me away when I see some of these descriptions online about how the market is starting the beginning of the October crash. And I just think, boy, we're not even down to the 50-day moving average, and people are worried already. And it's been, what, 2 weeks since an all-time high in the market? Now, I think it is worthwhile to explore how October crashes usually happen. October is the month that you remember, but usually the market actually tops sometime in August. And then volatility really picks up in September. And of course, October is the month where the market really dumps and everybody remembers it. Honestly, Patrick, I'm curious to get your take on this, but I don't see any sign of the kind of I don't think the top in August was a blow-off style top that typically looks like a market top, and I don't think the little bit of selling that we've seen it looks anything like the kind of, you know, increased volatility in September that tends to presage a crash. So I think if anything, the number of people that are focused on this October crash scenario just portends that much more likely of the opposite outcome. So let's come back to that in the postgame.
All right, Eric, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index because the dollar's been relatively weak for almost a month. But today, after the retail sales numbers, we have a pretty significant uptick. But I don't know if there's any major technical levels yet still taken out. What's your take on the dollar here as we're approaching 93?
Well, you said it all. You know, we're approaching 93. If we were approaching 95, I'd be much more interested. But, you know, we've been consolidating in this range between 89 and, I don't know, 93, 94 in there somewhere. The top of that range is not exactly clear. And it's going to take a significant breakout to really persuade me that there's a trend change. I haven't seen it yet.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil because there we have had a breakout. I mean, we're trading very close to 52-week highs. Haven't yet got up to like the 74, 75 level on spot, but definitely oil has been trending higher in the last month. What's your take? Did we go to new all-time new highs?
Your characterization was almost perfect. The only thing you left out, Patrick, was as predicted on Macro Voices, comma,
okay.
No, it's pretty much what we expected. I've been saying for a couple of weeks, I'm expecting that this route that we're in, what it's all about is there is a structural bull market in crude oil. But everybody had expectations of massive drawdowns occurring in August. They didn't happen in August the way they were expected because we had the Delta wave of COVID pickup. And also, I think the fears were a little bit exaggerated. That put the whole bull market on pause for July and August. And I think that bull market is back. I still think we're headed over 80. Obviously, it didn't happen before Labor Day, but I think we'll get there before the end of the year. And I think that we'll probably hit $100 before 2022 is out. With respect to inventory, Patrick, crude oil drew down 6.4 million barrels this week. That's a much bigger drawdown and very much in line with what people were expecting to see back in August. So we are getting those drawdowns finally. And remember the words of Phil Verleger, who told us that summer driving season has always been a fallacy and that the real phenomenon is summer home building season, which creates a huge amount of energy demand. Well, guess what, Patrick? The construction market is absolutely booming. Several people I've talked to can't get a contractor to call them back or to return their calls. That's how bad it is, or that's how busy it is, and I think that demand is going to continue. So I still think we're headed well over 80 before the year is out. In any event, Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 1.1 million barrels, gasoline drawing down 1.9 million barrels, and distillates drawing down 1.7 million barrels. U.S. production ticking up to 10.1 million barrels. Now, that's still way down from what it was before Hurricane Ida. Those effects of Hurricane Ida have been pretty persistent. Getting that production back online is going to take a little bit longer than some people at first anticipated. With respect to tape action, we had a face ripper of a rally before that data even came out. When the data came in and confirmed it, that we went even higher, kind of got to a blow off yesterday, a little bit of a retrace down to the volume weighted moving average this morning. And right now, as we're speaking before the close, we're still flirting just about a little bit below yesterday's highs. I won't be surprised if by the time our listeners hear this, if we've broken out above yesterday's highs. And I think we're headed much higher from here, Patrick.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because up until today, everything seemed rather quiet and benign, but a big breakdown today in gold headed down towards 1750, down almost 50 points at its worst. What's your take on the gold market?
Well, the gold market has been struggling for months and months here. It seems like it just can't get above 1830. That's where the moving averages were at the tests in July and August. And now those moving averages, 255-day moving average, and the 100 is also co-located in there somewhere, those have come back down to much lower numbers, around 1800. But it seems like the resistance level which stopped us is around 1833, which is also a pivot point on one of my chart studies, so that may be indicative. But you know, as far as where we go from here, so far the moving averages have broken down and it looks like we're headed lower. I won't be surprised if that turns around, but boy, that recovery that we've been waiting for to break out above the prior trading range has been very slow in coming.
All right, Eric, let's wrap up by touching on that 10-year Treasury yield. I know we got Jim Bianco coming on who will have some insights, but really it's been almost 2 months of just sideways price action as we pretty much have been pinned between 125 and 135 on the yield. Do you have any intuition as to where the break is going to happen?
Well, as you say, Patrick, it's been a few months now. Now, if you go back to World War II when interest rates bottomed then, it was like a decade that they just stayed at a permanent bottom before they really started to recover. So, as you said, Jim Bianco is really the expert on this. He's a very strong fixed income guy, so I'm looking forward to asking him these questions.
This week's feature interview guest is Bianco Research founder Jim Bianco. Now, Eric, why did we get Jim back on the show this week?
Well, Jim is one of our all-time favorite guests. He is the guy, in addition to Dr. Chris Martinson, who really nailed the COVID call. He was ahead of me and just about everybody else in terms of his graphs and charts and in making the call that we had a global pandemic coming back in January of 2020. And it's been a long time since we've had him on the show, so I don't think we're going to talk COVID in this interview, but we're going to talk about just about everything else.
Well, Eric's interview with Jim Bianco is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas NEO in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas NEO or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Bianco Research founder Jim Bianco. Jim, it's great to get you back on the program. It's been such a long time. For any new listeners who aren't familiar with Jim, he's kind of our Macro Voices hero, the guy, along with Dr. Chris Martinson, who really helped us be the first financial media outlet to call the COVID pandemic. So, Jim, it's great to have you back. I think we've already covered all of the pandemic stuff back when. So I want to talk about the new big trend, which I think is not just transitory inflation, like Janet says, but I think this is secular. What do you make of the inflation trend? And please make an argument either for or against secular as opposed to just cyclical inflation.
Yeah, put me in the persistent camp. I mean, that would be the opposite of transitory. I do think that what we're going to find over the next several months is the inflation is going to stick around a lot longer than we think, and it's going to be a bigger problem than we have. Let's take the data for starters. The day we're talking is the day that the CPI report was released. And let's break it into two broad categories. Transitory inflation, and that would be things like airline tickets, restaurants, rental cars, hotels, motels, and the like, and non-transitory items. And what you'll find is that the transitory items have definitely peaked and they're on their way down. But the non-transitory items, that's everything else, with the big part of that being shelter inflation, which includes owner's equivalent rent and rents of primary residence, that's moving up. And that's at the highest level, at least in 4 years, and making new highs. So there is a transition going on in the inflation dynamics from the transitory stuff to the more persistent stuff. Now, I'm not of the camp that inflation is going to be big numbers, like 5, 6, 7%, because I do believe that demographics, globalization, and technology will hold it down overall. But I think we could see a three handle stick around a lot longer than we think when it comes to inflation. And why is that an issue? Because we've got a 125 10-year note yield. If we had a 350 10-year note yield, eh, no big deal. But when you have a 125 10-year note yield and you have a realization that inflation might stick around in the three handle, that could pose a problem for the bond market. And if the bond market eventually gets a problem, then everybody has a problem.
We really haven't seen very much wage inflation yet, which a lot of people think is what starts that self-reinforcing cycle where the wage inflation, you know, means that the cost of everybody operating their business goes up and they all raise prices and then people feel like they need more money and they ask for higher wages and it just keeps cycling. Why haven't we really seen wages take off as we've seen commodity prices take off?
Well, to one extent, I do think we have seen wages take off. And the reason I think we've seen it take off is because it has been rebounding from the pandemic lows. So, you know, it's gone down, it's gone up, and it's now starting to make new highs. But to your larger point, you're right. A lot of people don't think we've seen a lot of real big inflation, but I think it's coming. And the reason I think it's coming is what the pandemic did is it accelerated trends that were already in place. One of the trends that it accelerated, we're, you know, conceptually speaking, 20 years ahead of where we should be, is in remote work, work from home. There is a big pushback in the economy right now about returning to the office. And it's not about health, and it's about that they don't want to be there, that they've looked at the situation and they've said that I've shown for the last year I could work from home. I don't want to be in the office anymore. Well, a lot of managers want people back in the office. A lot of businesses want people to take jobs where they have to commute to those jobs every day. Think waitress, think surgeon, think policeman, think construction worker. And the way that a lot of people are getting people to take these jobs is they're going to have to pay them more money. And I think we're beginning to see that now. In the latest payroll report, the wages in the leisure and hospitality industry is up over the last 3 months, 18%. 18% annualized rate over the last 3 months. Now, it's rebounding from a depressed low, so year over year isn't quite that big, but give it a couple of more months, and I think you're going to see these numbers start to really move. So I think there's been a change in the nature of work. And I might add, when I say there's been a change in the nature of work, it really comes down to where you are in your station in life. If you are a manager, an executive with people that you employ, you're probably thinking, oh, there's no change. They'll come back. They'll run out of money and they'll come back. And if you're a little bit younger, or if you're in that category of people that think that they've proven their job at home, you're thinking, no, we like it the way it is right now. We don't want to change. I'd rather quit my job than go back to the office. And we're seeing a lot of that right now.
Okay, Jim. So you're saying inflation is here. It's going to be persistent. Now, I want to talk about what that means in terms of what we can expect in markets, but let's start with monetary policy. Normally, we're taught, well, when inflation shows up, central banks respond by increasing interest rates. That's the traditional way that you fight inflation. A lot of people, myself included, have argued that we're now in kind of an inflation trap situation where the Fed can't really afford to significantly increase short-term interest rates because it would dramatically increase the U.S. government's cost of borrowing, and it would essentially bankrupt the country. Is that a real concern, and are we in a trap situation where it won't be possible to fight this inflation that you see coming because of that situation that we're in?
Yeah. Let's put it in terms of the way that the Fed is looking at things right now. They are suggesting in a lot of their work, well, let's back up. In 2019, they had a big thing called Fed Listens. It was a tour across the country. And the takeaway that they had from that was we need to focus more on employment. So last year, summer of last year, they put a subtle change to their employment number or to their mandate, where they're emphasizing employment. And that's where they talk about average inflation targeting, let things run a little bit hotter, because we've got to get people back to work. Within that respect, they've been pushing back on inflation constantly by saying, oh, it's transitory. Of course, they never tell you what transitory is, or do they tell you what they're doing about inflation to make it transitory? And the answer is they're not doing anything to make it transitory other than just announcing that it's transitory. So the Fed wants us to believe that inflation is transitory so that they can focus on the unemployment part of their job. And that's going to lead to a head at some point, as you said. On the one hand, they want to keep everything easy. They want money to keep flowing. They want markets up. They want people to feel aggressive, go out and hire, keep the economy moving. But if that meets headlong into persistent inflation, and what does persistent inflation do for the Fed? It makes bond investors think to themselves, I don't want to own bonds anymore, because if this 3% inflation rate is going to stick around for a while, why do I want to own something with a negative yield that loses me money? And then they're going to have a real problem on their hands. So yeah, I don't think the Fed is going to ever admit that there is persistent inflation. They're going to have to be dragged screaming and kicking by the markets in order to act on it. They'll just always dismiss it. They'll always say there's nothing to see here. They'll always look to continue to stay easy.
A lot of investors believe that there's an inherent relationship, that as inflation picks up, interest rates pick up. Is that how it works, or is the interest rates picking up something that only happens when the central bank, through monetary policy, is taking action to fight the inflation?
Oh, I think it's the latter. I don't think that there's a one-for-one relationship between inflation and interest rates. Now, big picture, if you want to show me a 100-year chart of inflation and a 100-year chart of interest rates, yes, you could then say that when inflation goes up, rates tend to go up, and when inflation goes down, rates tend to go down. But in the interim, there can be many months or years where they seem to diverge. Ultimately, remember, it is bond investors that buy bonds. And it is whatever motivates investors to want to own bonds or not own bonds. And one of the big things that motivates them is monetary policy. So if you've got an accommodative monetary policy with no inflation, and that the Fed is aggressively pushing up bond prices, I want to own bonds because the Fed's going to be the wind in my back. If you've got a monetary policy that is fostering inflation, meaning that my value of my money is going to depreciate faster than the interest that my bonds are going to give me, which is known as negative real rates, I don't want anything to do with bonds then at that point. So I agree with you. It's really about monetary policy. So as long as the Fed can just continue to be easy, the bond market will stay okay. When the Fed is forced to be a little bit more aggressive on monetary policy, then the bond market can run into trouble.
Now, Jim, you're an expert on fixed income. Something that's really been on my mind a lot lately is a lot of people are saying, look at this 35-year, or maybe it's longer than that, 37-year, whatever it is, bond bull market that we've had since the early 80s. We got down to, I forget what the intraday low was, 25 basis points or something on the 10-year at one point. And a lot of people are saying, okay, look, surely the bond bull market, it's got to be over now. And I think that's probably right. But then they jump immediately to, therefore, we're in a secular bond bear market. It's time to short everything. And I think, wait a minute, when interest rates bottomed after World War II, it was like 10 years before they really started taking off to the upside. So if, first of all, do you think interest rates have bottomed? But if they have bottomed, does that mean there's necessarily a secular bear market to follow? Or does it just mean we're going to stay bottomed for a long time?
I think they have bottomed. You're right. It was 39 years and we hit 33 basis points in the 10-year in March of 2020. I think that was it. And you're exactly right. I've used that same analogy myself too, that following the 1946 low in bond yields, which was a little over 1%, it was another 8 years or so that we, you know, that bonds still traded around 1.5%. Before rates really started to move up, especially by the time you got to the late 50s. So I think what you'll see is you'll see interest rates are going to continue to probably meander around, this one, maybe two handle for a while. Now, what's different now than in the 40s and the 50s is the sheer amount of leverage and financialization that there is in the bond market. Back then, there were bond traders, but they weren't, you know, as aggressive leveraged traders as they are now. And one of the things that I've cautioned about is, yes, if you're waiting for a big rise in rates, that's probably not going to happen for a number of years. But could rates shoot up to 2.5%? Sure. And if you're not a bond trader, you might shrug your shoulders and go 1.25, 2.5. Is that really that big a deal for the economy? If I'm borrowing a mortgage at 3%, does it now all of a sudden not work at 4, 4.25? Yeah, you're probably right. It's all the same there. But for bond traders, for leverage bond traders, for bond dealers, a move from 1.25 to 2.5, very painful, big losses, especially if it comes very quickly. So that's where I think it matters. And if the bond market gets wobbly, everybody else will get wobbly. Everybody else would be the stock market, the commodity markets, the gold markets. They would all respond in kind, I think, to a wobbly market. So keep in mind that even though I might say, look, I think we could see 2.5% on bonds, you know, within the next year, which I do think, that can wind up still being very painful for people in the bond market.
Let's come back to my question of, are we actually looking at just a cyclical pickup in rates here, or is there actually an argument for a secular bond bear market that's already begun?
I think there's an argument for a secular bear market in bonds that has already begun. Look, the three big factors that are holding down inflation, remember, 100-year chart bonds, 100-year chart interest rates, they seem to move a lot together with each other. The big factor that's holding down inflation is demographics, globalization, and technology. Demographics, we're getting older. As we get older, we tend to want to consume less stuff. You consume the most stuff when you're in your 30s and your 40s, when you're starting your career and you buy a house and you have kids. But when the kids all grow up and they leave and your grandparents and you retire, you consume far less. Globalization, you know, I can build this anywhere, wherever the cheapest costs are. And the relentless push of disinflation or even deflation from technology making everything cheaper and cheaper has held stuff down. Well, now that we're in 21, you could argue that some of those might be questionable. Let's start with globalization. Yes, globalization was a great thing, but all of a sudden there are nationalist movements all around the world. There is tension with the biggest manufacturer of the world, that is China, as well too. And so you could argue that maybe we've seen peak globalization, or we're very, very close to peak globalization. Demographics. There is a big wave of millennials and then Gen Y right behind them that is coming up, you know, in the demographic chain. So while we think about, the economy aging because of all the aging baby boomers. In a couple of years, that's going to start to revert back the other way as the Gen Yers come into their adulthood more often, and the millennials get a little bit older, and then they start wanting to buy houses, buy cars, have kids, and the like. Technology is the one thing that could continue to exert downward pressure on interest rates, but that's not enough by itself. It needs the D in demographics, and it needs the G in globalization, and those two might be questionable. If they are, there's your case for that inflation. The inflation down cycle ended too, and we might start to see a turn up in inflation. Same thing. Remember, inflation started to turn up in the early 60s. It took 10 years before it really started to take hold in the 70s. I think you could see something similar to that now. We've got a bottoming in inflation, and now we've got potentially a turn higher in inflation. One last thought for you on inflation. If you look back to the 1970s forward and you look at the inflation rate, the average inflation rate of every expansion was lower than the previous one. So the 70s had higher inflation than the 80s expansions. The 90s expansions had lower inflation than the 80s, so on and so forth. That cycle might be breaking now. The average inflation rate we've had since April of last year with the end of the recession is much higher than the average inflation rate that we had between 2000 and 2019. That'd be the first time in nearly 50 years that we've seen a turn up with the expansion. And so that suggests to me that maybe we've got a secular turn in the inflation rate. But again, don't think that we go from an inflation bottom, secular turn, to some magically high number on inflation right away. That could still be a decade plus away. But for right now, we're talking about a bottoming of inflation.
Okay, let's translate this to how you actually make money in markets, because it seems to me we've gone from really easy to really hard. And what I mean by that is in a bond bull market, you fixed income guys, from my perspective, don't have to work that hard. You buy long bonds, you get a little bit of return on the coupon and a whole bunch more return on the capital appreciation thanks to a trending market, and you're done. But if you think the opposite is happening, it's not quite so easy, because in that case, you had a double tailwind. You got capital appreciation and the coupon helping you. If you're going to short bonds because you've got a secular bearish view, you've got to pay the coupon in order to be short. And depending on how you're doing that short, whether it's in futures or in the actual bond market, you may be paying a borrow cost in order to short those bonds. So it seems like it's much harder, and then you just made it even harder than that, because when I said, is it about to really take off and go the opposite direction fast, you said, no, it could be a bunch of years before anything big happens. So what do you do in terms of how to trade that?
Yeah, it's going to be difficult. This is where the bond investor is going to get paid to earn his living right now, is to try and do something in this environment. So the first thing I'd say is that the secular nature of interest rates is over. You're right that, you know, you just had the wind at your back, just be long the market and don't do something stupid, and you made a lot of money. Well, now you're going to have to be a little bit more nimble, you know, picking the right credits, picking the right instruments, playing the yield curve correctly. This is all really hard stuff to do as well. But let me write your question bigger. And let me say that if you were to look larger, say, to the equity market and everything else, let's talk about how the markets have been working over the last several years. They've all been flow driven. If you look at valuations in the stock market, you'd be very hard pressed to make the statement that something in the stock market is cheap. There's nothing cheap about the stock market. It's either fully valued or it's overvalued. But why is it that it just relentlessly goes up? Because the flows just relentlessly keep coming into the stock market, just like the flows relentlessly keep coming into the bond market. Now, the difference is the flows in the bond market are largely coming from central banks. The Fed is buying $120 billion a month in bonds. That's $1.5 trillion a year. As I like to joke, they're buying bonds so you don't have to. And all that money then reaches for risk and buys stocks. And most of that it's going into the stock market and flows is going into index funds. Look at a chart of the S&P and look at a chart of the Russell 2000. They don't look much alike at all. And really what it is that most of the indexes are tied to the S&P, so it relentlessly goes up because money's flowing in. And there's a little bit of indexing in the Russell, but not as much as there is in the big cap index. And it is a little bit more independent of just the flows. So as long as the flows continue, bonds will, you know, meander sideways and probably have their fits and starts a little bit. Stock market will keep going up. You get a belief that inflation is persistent and a demand that the Fed do something about persistent inflation. That's code word for stop buying bonds. And if the Fed's going to stop buying bonds, I don't want anything to do with bond yields with a negative real yield. They sell off, the stock market gets very, very wobbly. So really, this is a story of you're playing flows. You're not playing valuations. You're not playing relative economy recoveries. And the flows at its bedrock is central bank flows, whether it's the PEP program from the ECB or the Fed or the yield curve control programs from the Bank of Japan or the Reserve Bank of Australia. They are producing flows, money to own bonds, even though they're having a difficult time going forward. But more importantly, they're telling everybody, you don't have to worry about the bond market too much. Go ahead and speculate in stocks. But the minute you get a perception that inflation is persistent, all that starts to reverse, and then you've got some issues on your hands.
Jim, do you think Jay Powell's going to be reappointed as Fed chairman? And if not, who is on deck and what are the consequences of a different chair?
Well, let's start with, yes, I do think he's going to get appointed. If you look at the prediction markets like predictit.com, there is a betting market out there that's got him at 90% being reappointed. Now, what's important to understand about this is the progressives in the Democratic Party, led by Elizabeth Warren, have made it very well known they don't want Jay Powell reappointed, full stop. They want him out. Their preferred choice is Lael Brainard, who is a Fed governor as well, too. And she's more of the progressive camp as well. Now, normally, when the progressives push on the Biden administration, they kind of get what they want. But in this case, doesn't look like they are going to get what they want because there's a fear of markets. There's a fear that if we don't satiate the markets by giving them the guy, the comfortable old sweater of Jay Powell, and we give them an unknown in Lael Brainard, that could upset things, so that they're going to at least acquiesce to that. So I suspect that Powell will be reappointed. If not, it will be a big shock. His term ends the end of January. If you work backwards with the Senate calendar to get him nominated, hearings, vote, it's got to come out probably in the second half of September, the announcement that he's going to get reappointed. Where I do think you might see a change is Rich Clarida, the vice chair, might be out, and that they might give Lael Brainard that position. They like her in the administration. She was on the short list to be Treasury Secretary. The scuttlebutt was she was ready to quit the Fed when she didn't get Treasury Secretary, and they told her, sit tight, we've got other plans for you. And that was kind of a wink nod that maybe Fed chairman, well, if they don't give her that, they got to give her something. And so I wouldn't be surprised if she winds up becoming the vice chair, and if at very least, the head of regulatory supervision for the Fed. Now, that would probably be a negative for the banks because they regulate the banks directly, but it wouldn't necessarily impact monetary policy. But if anything deviates from that, and what I've largely explained is somewhat of the consensus thinking, which I think in this case is right, Powell doesn't get it, Brainard doesn't get it, Clarida stays, some other thing that wasn't mentioned, then you've got potentially a market-moving event on your hands, the big one being if they don't give it to Jay Powell and they give it to somebody else. Because the other problem that they've had is they've looked at other candidates, Raphael Boskin of the Atlanta Fed as one example. Problem with him is he's a hawk, and that's one of the reasons why he's probably been scratched off the short list because the markets wouldn't like the idea of a guy that if it was up to him, we'd already be in the taper right now. It's not up to him. He's just one of the regional presidents. He's not the Federal Reserve chairman.
Jim, so far we've been talking primarily about U.S. policy and markets. Let's expand this globally. And I want to talk specifically about China, because I just see between the China conflict with the West seems to be heating up. I just saw over the weekend, it looks like China's relations with Taiwan are heating up. Where is this headed, both economically and geopolitically, and what should investors be thinking about here?
So let's put this in a little bit of perspective. This started a year ago when Jack Ma, the head of Alibaba and Ant Financial, gave a speech, and he basically criticized the banking system in China as being unfair for the working class and the poor. And that kicked off a whole series of events at that point, starting with Alibaba spun off their financial services into Ant, A-N-T Financial. At its peak valuation, it was worth $150 billion, 50% more than Goldman Sachs. That was largely taken away from him by the Chinese government. And in news this week, their very popular money transfer app, Alipay, is being told to divest itself of its lending and breaking it up into a lot of different avenues. The Chinese have also come down hard on a lot of the tech companies. They've come down on Didi. That's their ride sharing. It's five times the size of Uber. They punished them for listing on the New York Stock Exchange and not staying in Hong Kong or in Shanghai as far as listing to raise capital. They've come down on their education companies. In China, it's very competitive to get your kids into school. So there's these after-school tutoring programs, which are so big that they're publicly traded companies. But a lot of these after-school tutoring programs have been really geared towards getting your kids to pass tests to go to a Western university, either in the United States or in Europe. They've cracked down on that as well, too, and they've been cracking down on a number of companies as well. I think it's made China uninvestable from a foreigner point of view. If you buy a Chinese stock and it goes up, what do you own? They've already shown that it might be the CCP that owns these companies, and you're just a caretaker for them until they decide that they're going to take it from you. And so that's the real fear that you've got to have. You know, question is, what do you own? The bigger question is, what is China doing? Why are they doing this now? I think it has a lot to do with their economy slowing. Their economy is definitely slowing. Their economy definitely has some issues. There are some rumblings within the Chinese population. Look, they're very unhappy about having to be locked down last year. They're very unhappy about the lack of opportunities that they've had as well, too. They're very unhappy about the amount of opportunities that the wealthy have had in China. So they've been kind of soaking the rich. I think they're doing a mistake in China to the extent that they need an entrepreneurial class to create the Alipays, to create the DDs, to create a lot of these companies as well, too. And if those budding entrepreneurs are not treated well, they're going to go somewhere where they are treated well, whether that's Silicon Valley or Europe or Singapore or anywhere else. Certainly can't be Hong Kong anymore because they've effectively taken over Hong Kong as well, too. So I do think that in the picture there is a message for investors. What do you own if you own China? And is this a signal that China is slowing? And let's go back to our earlier conversation about globalization holding down inflation. That's another reason why we could see fraying of the globalization between China and the West if China wants to continue to promote policies that are going to be at odds with Western values as well, too.
Jim, we just did a special with Dr. Pippa Malmgren and Clint Cox for our August summer special talking about the coming decentralized finance revolution. And I am absolutely convinced, although I don't think the cryptocurrencies themselves have as big of a future as the crypto fan club thinks, I'm convinced that the technology they invented is going to be used by someone, if not the crypto people, then by central banks, to completely change not just the currency system, but the entire global financial system. I think most Americans just assume, obviously, that's a big bunch of technology and financial progress, so it's going to happen in the United States. You think it's going to happen in the United States, or you think that maybe the Chinese government's a little bit ahead of the U.S. government in terms of figuring out how strategic this is to the future of the world?
Well, I agree with you that the United States has got a real issue. Let's back up. Decentralized finance is the ability to do banking without banks, do brokerages without broker companies, to do trading without exchanges, to do insurance without insurance companies. We don't need those companies if decentralized finance fulfills its promise. In the United States, when you say, here's a way that we could do banking without banks, and we don't need brokerages, and we don't need exchanges, everybody looks aghast in horror, especially the regulators, because that's their livelihood. We can't have that. But if you look in the rest of the world, where the majority of people in a lot of countries are unbanked, that is an opening, a real opportunity for them to raise their standards of living. So I agree with you. Decentralized finance and the whole ideas behind it is coming one way or another. The loser in that scenario is the top dog, the reserve currency country that has all of the institutions, and that is the United States. But if you look at a breakdown of where cryptocurrency trading is taking place, Chain Analysis does a good one of this. Of the top 20 countries where you can find crypto trading, only one developed country is in the top 20, and that's the United States at number 9. Vietnam happens to be number 1, and they've got a new entrant at number 20, and that's Afghanistan. And that's because there's no functional financial system in Afghanistan, and they're turning to crypto in a big way. Because remember, the one constant that every country has is cell phones and mobile phone usage. So everybody can download an app and can get started with crypto, even in Afghanistan, if they have to. So don't automatically think that it's all terrorist money and drug money that's doing this. This is the merchant and the consumer on the streets of Kabul trying to figure out how to earn a living and how to get paid is what this is. And the reason I detailed that is because that's where it's coming from. So if the United States, if the SEC or the CFTC, or who I think is behind all of this is Janet Yellen at the Treasury, is going to want to say crypto bad, decentralization, we have to, and they keep using the words investor protection, where I think they really mean incumbent protection, then the U.S. is going to sit it out. We'll just let the rest of the world design the new financial system. Or we could say, look, we've got a hand or experience in running a global financial system. Let us help you design this system as we move forward from here. Right now, the U.S. doesn't want to do that. The U.S. wants to try and regulate it out of existence, but they're not going to be able to because it's so much in the rest of the world. Let me push back one place a little bit on you here, and that's China. China's thrown all the Bitcoin miners out of its country. China has designs to have its own digital currency, the digital yuan, with hopes that it would become a reserve currency, not the reserve currency, but a reserve currency. The problem China's been facing is they've been testing their digital yuan in China, and a lot of people shrug their shoulders and say, yeah, it's nothing big. I like Alipay better. I like WeChat Pay better. It does more things. It's more interesting to me than your digital currency. And in typical communist Chinese fashion, when you've unveiled a product and then they said that the private sector has come up with a better product, they say, oh, well, let's make the private sector version worse. So let's break up Alipay. Let's put restrictions on WeChat Pay. Let's make them crappier so that our substandard product, their digital yuan, looks relatively better. So China's at risk of missing this too, largely because they've got their designs on their own digital currency, the digital yuan. They're probably going to roll it out at the Winter Olympics and then push real hard after the Olympics to try and see if they can get adoption on that as well.
Now, obviously, it's hard to have a crystal ball here, but it seems to me that all of the smartest guys in finance all see the same thing that you and I do, which is clearly there's going to be a decentralized finance revolution that's going to change everything and disintermediate finance, and it's going to be a completely different landscape 25 years from now. But each one of those guys seems to have a different vision of what that actually means and what it looks like. So let's hear your version, Jim.
Well, first of all, let me say you're absolutely right, because you could basically back up 20 years ago or 25 years ago and talk about the vision of the internet. And you could have been completely right and said, I think that things like search are going to really drive the internet and internet retailing is going to take off. And 20 years ago, you would have plowed all your money in the Lycos and you would have plowed all your money in the pets.com and both of them went to zero. Okay. Well, then, maybe then I'll plow my money into Alta Vista. And it went to zero as well, too. And then you would have given up on the idea that the internet was going to be anything more than a sophisticated fax machine, as Paul Krugman famously said in the late 1990s. And then it took off and it changed everything. That's the problem you're going to face with decentralized finance. Yes, I can agree, you can agree with a lot of people. Boy, this is coming and this is going to be big. But how? How do I invest in it? How do I make money on it? Where's it going to be big? The risk is the big thing that it's going to be doesn't yet exist. And a lot of the stuff we're investing in now might all be destined to go to zero. And the Google of this that's going to be the transformational part is still to come. Remember, Google didn't even come into existence as far as a public stock until 2004, 4 years after the tech bust as well. So that's going to be the issue with it. Right now, I think as I look at everything, I think the place I'm focused most on is in the blockchain technologies and tokens that have smart contracts tied to them. That would be Ethereum. That would be Cardano. That would be Polkadot. That would be Solana and the likes of those. And to say, are those technologies and are those systems that they've set up, those protocols that they set up, are they in the process of becoming the foundation for this DeFi world? And I think in some respects, the answer is yes for most of them. They all have their issues. Some of them, like the Solanas of the world, are not decentralized enough so that one or two actors can have a big influence on them. Some of them, like Ethereum, are very decentralized, so no one can exert control over it. But its processing is too slow to actually try and be the foundation of the world's financial system. They need to speed that up without losing their decentralization. They've got some plans for it, but that's a tall order as well, too. And there's more ideas that are coming as well. But I would say to most people, this isn't necessarily, we're not necessarily at a stage where it's, here's how you make money in this. I want to say this is more like the early 90s. Spend some time to understand this space. Spend some time to learn what's happening in this space, because it is going to be big and it is going to be significant. Although maybe it's not going to be Ethereum, or maybe it's not going to be Cardano or Polkadot or Solana or any of these others. Maybe it's going to be something that doesn't yet exist, or maybe it will be those and others as well too. So I still think we're kind of at the feeling around in the dark spot, but I do think we are all on a journey and we all know where that journey is going to lead to. As you said, Eric, in 20, 25 years, there's going to be a wholesale change in the financial system as we know it today.
Let's talk about your expertise area, which is fixed income specifically. It seems to me that decentralized finance has more applications in fixed income probably than anywhere else. And the reason I say that is, as you alluded, once you've got programmable money and smart contracts, a bond could literally be something different than what it is today. A bond today is a promise for an issuer to repay if they keep their promise. But you could design a new kind of bond, Jim, where it's an obligation to repay, where the system itself essentially forces the issuer, if it has either savings or income, you know, if it has a revenue stream, it could be designed to essentially capture that revenue stream. So you could have revenue bonds that are programmed in through smart contracts. That seems to me like as soon as somebody comes up with a really novel, innovative, and I don't think it's a software guy, but I think it's a fixed income guy like yourself that says, wait a minute, we could never do X before, but we can do it now because we've got this programmable capability where even if the issuer wants to default, they can't. It seems to me like that, if somebody invents something like that, it could be a total game changer for the fixed income market. Am I wrong?
No, you're exactly right. And I think, you know, to make it better understood for people, let's say the same thing you did with the terms that you hear in the crypto space, tokenomics. One of the things, you're right, you've got smart contracts, you've got programmable money. Okay, so a bunch of coders know how to program money. But how do they set up the proper incentives? And how do they set up the proper reward systems so that a token, which would be the equivalent of a bond that you were talking about in your scenario, would flourish, that people would want to own that token, that people would want, you know, it by owning this token, it gives me some kind of rights to a revenue stream, an asset, or some kind of privilege that, you know, you could you can get from the token that you can't get from other places. I give you a good example. There's been an argument that's been made, and I happen to agree with this argument, that one of the things that say, a Tesla and an Apple have going for it is that the people that buy Teslas and buy Apple phones tend to own their stock, and they tend to be cheerleaders for those stocks as well, especially Tesla. I mean, most people that own the Tesla car also bought the stock. And then they brag about the company because they're a part owner. They want to see the stock go up and they benefit from it. How about a dollar store, a Dollar Tree, or in a McDonald's? Most of the people that shop at those places are not owners of the company and they don't own the stock. But what if they issued a token and that token gave them discounts and certain privileges? And as they talked up the virtues of their of those companies or any other company along those lines, those tokens appreciate in value. And all of a sudden, they now partake in the same way that a Tesla owner owning Tesla stock partakes. You could change the whole dynamic of the way that markets work and the market structures are. The other thing that decentralized finance does is it removes the privilege out of decentralized finance. The difference between you and me and Warren Buffett would be the number of zeros after the size of his order or our order. It would not be the terms of the deal, because I've always bristled about these books that say invest like Warren Buffett. Boy, I would love to. I would love people to call me up and give me sweetheart deals out of the blue like they give to Warren Buffett, but they don't. I don't get the same deal that Buffett does. But in a decentralized finance world, we all get the same deal. He can just add more zeros to the end of the deal, but the terms are all exactly the same as well too. So you're right. This can really democratize finance. This can really change the outlook for the markets. And it, of course, no one wants that right now. Like one of the big things that we have is we have this thing called accredited investors that you need to have $1 million in order to put your money into like some kind of a hedge fund or some kind of a limited partnership that could give you, you know, abnormal returns, because they've decided that as a substitute for investor intelligence, we're going to use net worth. I think that's a terrible rule, because there are plenty of people that don't have $1 million that are completely capable of understanding a lot of these products and should have the opportunity to invest in them. In the decentralized world, that won't be. Everybody gets the same deal. So yes, you're right. It will change a lot of how the system works. It will democratize it. It will give everybody fair footing on what they could wind up doing. And it could turn everybody into a projected owner or an advocate for whatever it is that they own, even if it's down to like a McDonald's or something like that, which you largely don't get right now.
Jim, part of your answer was that it democratizes finance, but you also said earlier that this is going to enable a market without brokers, and a market without institutions, the ability to trade assets without middlemen. It seems to me that if you democratize finance, you're really putting a lot of very, very powerful people who are behind the biggest lobby in the United States, the Wall Street political lobby, you're kind of putting them out of business with a lot of what you're talking about. So how likely, I mean, how's this going to go? Because on one hand, it's very clear to me that the future of finance is decentralized finance. That's where it's all going to be. But, you know, usually the people that are being displaced, the dinosaurs that are getting put out of business, don't go down without a fight. So are people going to wise up and be part of the future, or are they going to fight this?
Oh, they're going to fight it, and they are fighting it. 50% of all crypto owners reside in Asia. There are more crypto owners in the continent of Africa than there are in the United States right now. If you look again at the chain analysis numbers, they're not going to accept that the United States Securities and Exchange Commission is going to shut all this stuff down in the name of investor protection. They've never had investor protection. They've been unbanked. They have been subject to scams and to losing their money for their whole life. They see this as a way for them to have a fair fight in the economy and in the money-changing business. And so I think that, yes, they're going to fight it, but they, Janet Yellen or Gary Gensler, cannot convince the continent of Africa or the continent of Asia to give up on this, because it's in their interest. The Chinese can't even get their own population to really give up on this, even though they've kicked all the miners out of their country as well, too. So I ultimately think, just like big city mayors with Uber, you know, they threw them all out. They called it illegal. They said you needed to get a taxi cab license to operate on their streets. But their populations wanted it so bad that they were forced to basically cave and allow it to happen. The same thing will happen here. Now that I've said that, it's not going to be clean and it's not going to be simple. It can be very messy along the way as they try to fight on this. But I do think that you're right. They're not going to give up without a fight. But at some point, they're going to have to realize it's a fight they can't win. And then the question is just how bad do they want to wreck everything on the way out the door?
Jim, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell us a little bit about what you do at Bianco Research. And for our listeners who want to follow your work, how they can do so.
We are an independent research firm. The best way is you could check out our website at biancoresearch.com. Follow me at Bianco Research on Twitter or Jim Bianco on LinkedIn. I try to, you know, post things from time to time in both of those spaces as well, too.
And I've seen a lot of excellent articles on LinkedIn particularly. Jim, we look forward to getting you back on the program soon for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of Freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF, and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Jim back on the show. You know, when he was talking about interest rates and bonds and really what can happen in terms of the market responding to potentially inflation pressures, it made me really kind of reflect upon a lot of this financial repression that we have seen in the markets and whether it can persist. It's a really amazing conversation to have, and it's great to hear Jim's views. What did you take away from the interview?
Patrick, I couldn't agree more with what you said. And for me, it's always a pleasure to talk to Jim Bianco because he's such a smart guy. Talking to him about the interplay between interest rates and inflation and central bank policy and which one is really driving which and how it all works and so forth. He's really the right guy for that. And I think it's a very timely conversation. In any event, speaking of timely conversations, I want to move on to our post-game chart deck, which is titled Sizing Up, the Markets and Emergent Trends. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to your homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, let's take a look at the chart deck. Starting on page two, we've got that S&P 500, and boy, looks like we're just about flirting with that 50-day moving average.
Well, Eric, exactly. Like all summer, we've been showing this chart with the 50-day exponential moving average on it. And what we've seen was the pattern develop almost all year, which is that the market trades down to its 50-day moving average, which is just an average price, which is a typical type of a retracement of a prior rise, immediately find support. And the next leg of a rally would begin off of that pivot. And so we're interestingly at that same inflection point again. And it's really interesting to see whether or not the markets will once again deliver a deja vu event as we approach this area, which the ascending trend line and Fibonacci zones all measure to. And what's interesting, though, about this sell-off that's slightly variant from the ones that we've seen in the past is that almost all of the ones we've seen over the summer had some sort of a almost 100 S&P point drop, like a one day that was kind of like a market gets spooked and it gets down to that moving average, and then a reflexive rally almost immediately would begin, and we would be just a new bull run would just be, have slingshotted higher from that. What's interesting is that the sell-off down to this 50-day moving average this time around has not only now been double the amount of days, but we haven't had a really big down day. It's just been these a slow methodical crawl lower down to these supports. And even yesterday on Wednesday, when we had a reflexive rally, it didn't hold. And the market today is all giving almost all of it back. And so it's interesting that we're at the exact same point, but how we got here and the fact that we haven't seen any real heavy selling makes it a little bit different. And it's an inflection point where really, if the pattern persists, then the buy on dip traders should emerge here somewhere. And if they did, there's at least 150 to 200 S&P points upside if we use the analog of any of those prior rallies. At the same time, wouldn't it be interesting if this was the first time we had a break of that 50-day moving average, and especially if it happened here this week where we have the OPEX, where there's a whole bunch of gamma stuffed into these dealer books that could potentially exacerbate a sell-off. Now, that's not a forecast, but it is certainly a reality as we go into Friday. Now, one way or another, I think it's a really interesting moment to almost approach the market in a straddle-style way, which is like, look, if the market is going to rally, then this is actually a great buy on dip point. And if it's going to sell off, this is exactly where it would accelerate. And so it's a very important moment on the S&P chart to watch just to see which way the next trend emerges.
Patrick, let's move on to page 3 and the euro.
Right. And so we typically talk the dollar index, and the largest component of that and the real driver of the dollar index is the euro as it's trade weighted. And so the euro has been very weak. And what we had today was a legitimate breakdown of the euro, which drove that short term rise in that US dollar. And what's interesting is, again, we're at a very critical support line. This is where the euro has found lows in the past. So it's in a clear downtrend. It's coming to some key supports. And I think this is going to be a really important moment where we're going to get a tell, because if the US dollar was to break out as the euro breaks a major support line, there's all sorts of intermarket implications to that that will send shockwaves through the inner markets. And it's not necessarily that I'm forecasting them, but it's interesting that, you know, as we are at a very critical level on the S&P, we're also approaching some critical levels on a lot of the different currencies and other markets. And maybe September, October will have some sort of a big move. And it's going to be really interesting to see what these currencies do at these levels.
Let's move on to my favorite chart, which is crude oil on page 4.
Right. I just wanted to observe here that crude oil is really decoupled from a lot of the other commodities. It's the one that's running, but a lot of the other commodities continue to struggle, particularly in this period where the U.S. dollar might be strengthening. We're approaching that previous high where we're going to get, I think, at least crude oil bumping its head along that resistance. Not that I would imply anything bearish from that, but it'll be really interesting to see whether the bulls can hold the line up here and whether or not we do get that 52-week high, because really, in my mind, a breakout in crude oil from these previous highs could easily head up to $80+ on a short-term basis. And I know there's some bigger, longer-term targets that you can target, but it'll be really interesting to see whether the oil bulls can build on that. What are you watching for here?
Well, certainly breaking through to new highs above the red line you have on the chart there at $74 is going to be important. I think really, though, it's going to be the trend in inventory drawdowns and how long those big drawdowns last into the fall. Normally, seasonality says when summer, quote, that's air quotes, driving season ends, that we should expect a decrease in demand. If Phil Verleger is right and it's really about summer construction season, I'm quite certain that's continuing. continuing through the fall. So it's going to be really interesting, but I think that we're headed above 80 before this year is over. We'll see what happens. Let's move on to natural gas on page 5.
Well, what's interesting about nat gas is that it's one of the commodities here that has actually gone parabolic. And we saw that earlier in the year in lumber prices. And what's interesting is that while natural gas is doing this, there seems to be all sorts of shortages stories that are going around. But it also is driving coal prices. And it's the same time as uranium's running, which we'll talk about in a moment. But one thing that we can really see here, though, is that typically when we get to a parabolic stage of a rise like this, while you don't want to try to be too bold and predict the price level from which the highs were will come in, the one thing that we have talked about in the past on the show is that when these parabolic rises tend to occur, they tend to blow off and mean revert often deeply. And what will be really interesting to see is whether natural gas follows that type of an analog. You know, it wouldn't be a shocker to see nat gas print $6 or higher in this impulse. But what's interesting is that once it runs out of momentum on the upside, how deep will it drop on the other side of that mountain? It would be interesting to see whether or not we're going to see $5 and $4 prices on a pullback on the other side.
Patrick, let's move on to uranium on page 6. Holy cow.
Well, exactly. Like in page 6 and page 7 is the uranium stocks with the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF that we've featured on Macro Voices in the past. Like, I mean, both of them have pretty much in a span of just several weeks almost doubled in price. And just an extraordinary and very explosive move in uranium and uranium stocks. Again, we're in a situation where it's probably gone too much too quickly on the short term. But one thing that's for sure is that uranium bulls are now finally being rewarded for their patience, and we're seeing that a new bull trend is here. You know, while I anticipate that both of them will likely pause and mean revert some of this rise, I also think that this could be the beginning of a trend that may last for many months and may still go higher. So maybe all dips should be bought at this stage.
You know, Patrick, I just had lunch with Marin Katusa yesterday, and I think we agree with you on this, which is what's going on here is the fundamental drivers for uranium couldn't be more bullish. It's a really good story. However, with a great big underscore, Sprott entering this market, along with this Wall Street Bets propaganda, whatever you want to call it, around uranium, is really, really goosed this thing to the point where there's a significant short-term risk of some kind of blow-off here as that extreme momentum wears off and maybe a retrace. Think what happened to GameStop, the Wall Street Bets manipulation stock. You know, they got it way the heck up to ridiculously high levels, but with a lot of up and down along the way. So far, uranium's been straight up. I think we're in for at least a correction, but I do think that we're going much higher before this is ultimately over because they're right about the fundamentals. And of course, everybody's focused on those fundamentals. I still think it was the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF advertising on Macro Voices that started this entire trend of uranium stocks. But that's just my take. Let's move on to gold futures on page 8.
Right. And what's interesting is, well, we'll talk gold futures here, but gold miners and silver and actually some of the other precious metals have all had a pretty bad down day today. And they've all really reversed back down. I mean, one of the things that I was observing about the reflexive rally that we saw throughout August in gold was that often these have to go back and retest some of those levels. And what we're probably seeing here is some sort of a key retest to just determine whether or not gold is putting in a bottom or not. And so one of the things is not necessarily to make the forecast if it is, but rather to really watch. I think the next week or two of price action in gold is going to be pretty critical, because if the bulls dig in and use this as a buy on dip opportunity and we find ourselves higher later in the next week or two, then that could actually start to solidify that a change in the trend from what's been in place for almost a year plus now might actually start working on the upside. But I think it's very early to make that call. But I think that the kind of big tell is going to happen here in the next week or two.
Is this an inverse head and shoulders that's formed since the middle of June here?
Well, if it starts to rally off this point, many technicians will see that pattern for sure. And that's why I think whether or not gold makes it all the way back to its previous lows or whether it turns off of this little dip is going to be a key part of determining whether that is a turn point.
Let's move on to page 9 and copper futures still consolidating.
Yeah, what's interesting is that, well, you know, while we see oil breaking out, it's one of the few commodities that is, I mean, and uranium, of course. But when you look here, copper had that extraordinary bull run that ran through the first half of 2021. But really, we've been now in a multi-month consolidation. And what was really interesting is last week, we had a really nice bullish breakout attempt to the upside of copper. And the bulls couldn't hold it. And so far, they've given back the entire breakout attempt. At a minimum, what that is telling me is that it just might be a little bit early for the next bull run on copper to get in started. It'll be interesting to see where and how the supports hold during these consolidations. And we'll be looking for when there is a bull breakout that sticks. But right now, so far, the one that started last week has not been sticking.
Now, Patrick, when we talk bond yields on Macro Voices, we normally start with the U.S. 10-year Treasury. How come we're looking at the 30-year Treasury here on page 10?
Well, it's interesting is because when you go farther out on the yield curves, you're actually seeing that they're becoming actually less and less responsive to these inflation pressures. And what's interesting is that that 30-year yield still hovering around 188 here, well under 2%, in spite of the fact that inflation is probably running the hottest it's been in a very, very long time. And it's interesting to see that it's just simply not responding. And one of the ways to kind of reflect on that is because the five-year yield has been somewhat working higher. When we look on page 11 and look at the 530s yield curve, what you can see here is that this continues to decline. It's almost like the market is really almost buying in the transitory inflation argument, at least reflected in this. And really, anyone who's been predicting inflation and using the bond market as the way to express it has really not been rewarded at all for that making that call right. And it's interesting how the bond market continues to manifest itself. But what is the most interesting about that is if you go on page 12, where we show the iShares TIPS bond ETF, one of the best ways then to reflect or capture that has been to be long TIPS because they're actually pricing in that inflation versus those 30-year yields and 10-year bonds and so on that have not been reflecting that. And so it's going to be really interesting to me to see whether the TIPS continue to outperform here in the next little while.
And listeners, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, be sure to check out page 13 where you can get a free trial of Big Picture Trading, Patrick's service, and get Patrick's webinars every single day of the week. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book, which is discussed here in the post game. There's also a link to a Knowledge Leaders Capital article on the five divergences in the stock market to keep an eye out for in the fall, as well as a great interview with Lynn Alden on the biggest thing in macro. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. And for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit bigpicturetrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.